When training to develop wisdom, you are seeking through analysis to find the inherent existence of whatever object you are considering, whether this be yourself, another person, your body, your mind, or anything else. You are analyzing not the mere appearance, but the inherent nature of the object. Thus, it is not that you come to understand that the object does not exist. Rather, you find that its apparent inherent existence is unfounded. Analysis does not contradict the mere existence of the object. Phenomena do indeed exist, but not in the way we think they do. What is left after analysis is a dependently existent phenomena. When, for example, you examine your own body, its inherent existence is negated. But what is left is a body dependent on four limbs, a trunk, and a head. Whenever we think about objects, do we mistakenly believe that they exist in their own right? No. We can conceive of phenomena in three different ways. Let us consider a tree. There is no denying that it appears to inherently exist, but we could conceive of the tree as existing inherently in its own right. Or we could conceive of the tree as lacking inherent existence. Or we could conceive of the tree without thinking that it inherently exists or that it does not inherently exist. Only the conception of the tree as existing inherently is wrong. The tree does not inherently exist in its own right. It is right to conceive of the tree as lacking inherent existence, and it is also right to conceive of the tree without thinking either that it inherently exists or that it does not inherently exist. Even though the modes of apprehension are right in these two types of conception, the mode of appearance is still mistaken in that the tree appears as if inherently existent. If objects do not inherently exist, does this mean that they cannot function? Jumping to the conclusion that because the true nature of objects is emptiness, they are therefore incapable of performing functions, such as causing pleasure or pain, or helping or harming, is the worst sort of misunderstanding, a nihilistic view. As the Indian scholar yogi Nagarjuna says in his precious garland, a nihilist will certainly have a bad transmigration upon rebirth, whereas a person who, albeit wrongly, believes in inherent existence will go on to a good transmigration. Allow me to explain this. You need a belief in the consequences of actions to choose virtue in your life and discard non-virtue. For the time being, the subtle view of the emptiness of inherent existence might be too difficult for you to understand without falling into the trap of nihilism, where you are unable to understand that phenomena arise in dependence on causes and conditions, which we call dependent arising. For the sake of your spiritual progress, it would be better for now to set aside trying to penetrate emptiness. Even if you mistakenly believe that phenomena inherently exist, you can still develop an understanding of dependent arising and apply it in practice. This is why even Buddha, on occasion, taught that living beings and other phenomena inherently exist. Such teachings are the thought of Buddha's scriptures, but they are not his own final thought. For specific purposes, he sometimes spoke in non-final ways. Because all phenomena appear to exist in their own right, all of our ordinary perceptions are mistaken. Only when emptiness is directly realized during completely focused meditation, is there no false appearance? At that time, the dualism of subject and object has vanished, as has the appearance of multiplicity. Only emptiness appears. After you rise from that meditation, once again, living beings and objects falsely appear to exist in and of themselves. But through the power of having realized emptiness, you will recognize the discrepancy between appearance and reality. Through meditation, you have identified both the false mode of appearance and the false mode of apprehension. Let us return to the central point. All of us have a sense of I, but we need to realize that it is only designated depending on mind and body. The selflessness that Buddhists speak of refers to the absence of a self that is permanent, partless, and independent, or more subtly, selflessness can refer to the absence of the inherent existence of any phenomenon. However, Buddhists do value the existence of a self that changes from moment to moment, designated depending upon the continuum of mind and body. All of us validly have this sense of I. When Buddhists speak of the doctrine of selflessness, we are not referring to the non-existence of this self. With this I, all of us rightfully want happiness and do not want suffering. It is when we exaggerate our sense of ourselves and other phenomena to mean something inherently existent that we get drawn into many, many problems. Summary for daily practice. As an exercise in identifying how objects and beings falsely appear, try the following. 1. Observe how an item such as a watch appears in a store when you first notice it. Then, observe how its appearance changes and becomes even more concrete as you become more interested in it. And finally, observe how it appears after you have bought it and consider it to be yours. 2. Reflect on how you yourself appear to your own mind as if inherently existent. Then reflect on how others and their bodies appear to your mind. The Middle Way. Buddhist texts tell us that upon realizing emptiness, the illusion of inherent existence weakens. But this is unlikely after a single brief realization. If you have not attained one-pointed concentration, that is to say, calm abiding of the mind, you cannot use mere understanding of emptiness to uproot the illusion of inherent existence. Rather, you need to engage in analysis again and again. Through concentrated meditation, your mind will become strong, deep, stable, and capable of one-pointed concentration on emptiness. This will gradually work to diminish grosser levels of the misperception of reality. This is the reason why Buddhist sutras, as well as the three lower tantras, all say that calm abiding is a prerequisite for special insight, or, in another way, that concentrated meditation is a prerequisite for wisdom. The stabilizing meditation used in calm abiding and the analytical meditation used in special insight are not differentiated by the objects of meditation. Both could have either emptiness or conventional phenomena as their focus. The difference is that observing emptiness from within a state of calm abiding requires physical and mental suppleness induced through stabilizing meditation on emptiness. Whereas special insight, observing emptiness, additionally involves physical and mental suppleness induced by analytical meditation with respect to emptiness. That degree of suppleness can only be gained after attaining the easier level of suppleness produced by stabilizing meditation. Therefore, you need to achieve calm abiding before special insight. Although calm abiding could be achieved through taking emptiness as its object, this is only for practitioners who have already understood emptiness. Usually, however, practitioners first achieve one-pointed meditation and then gain the view of emptiness through reasoned analysis. All Buddhist schools agree that the analytical reasoning process, which leads to an inference, this being a conceptual realization, derives from basic, shared, direct perception. As an example, let us consider this reasoning. A plant does not inherently exist because of being a dependent arising. You begin by reflecting on the fact that a plant is a dependent arising because its production depends on certain causes and conditions such as a seed, soil, sunlight, and water. But eventually, the reasoning process must be supported by direct perception or it cannot stand. We can see with our eyes that plants change. They grow, mature, and finally dry up. In this sense, inference is blind, since it must eventually rely on direct perception. Inference depends on reasoning, which in turn rests on basic, shared, indisputable experience through direct perception. Knowable objects can be divided into the obvious, the slightly obscure, and the very obscure. In order to understand a very obscure topic, it is necessary to rely on scripture. But even for this type of inference, it is not sufficient just to cite one scripture as validation for another. Rather, you must analyze whether there are any internal contradictions among scriptures on that topic. You must also analyze whether there is any contradiction between what the scripture says about that topic and what is evident in direct perception. Beyond that, you must analyze whether there is any contradiction between what the scripture says about that topic and what can be understood through basic inference derived by reasoning. So, even in these very obscure cases based on scripture, analysis is needed. Buddha set out 4 steps for establishing reliability. 1. Do not rely just on the person, but rely on the doctrine. 2. With respect to the doctrine, do not rely on just the words, but rely on the meaning. 3. With respect to the meaning, do not rely just on meaning that requires interpretations, but rely on meaning that is definitive. And 4. With respect to the definitive meaning, do not rely on just dualistic understanding, but rely on the wisdom of direct perception of the truth. Buddha also said, like gold, which is chosen by a goldsmith upon being scorched, cut, and rubbed, my word is to be adopted by monastics and scholars upon analyzing it well, not out of respect for me. In the process of reasoning, it is very effective to state absurd consequences of wrong views in order to overcome the potency or vibrancy of that wrong idea and then make a proof statement. When I was studying logic as a youth, a scholar once told me that both in debate with a Buddhist who asserts inherent existence and in your own analytical meditation, it is a rather soft approach to use a syllogistic statement such as, my body is without inherent existence because it is a dependent arising. However, it has more impact to use an absurd consequence, such as, it follows that my body could not be a dependent arising because it inherently exists. This is because it is fundamental to Buddhism that all phenomena are dependent arisings. Buddha himself, in setting forth sutras, and Nagarjuna and his spiritual sons, Aryadeva, Buddhapalita, and Chandrakirti, in commenting on the meaning of those sutras, use the fact that phenomena are dependent arisings as the final reason for establishing emptiness. This indicates that phenomena in general are not non-existent and that impermanent phenomena are fit to perform functions. When Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, first he identified true sufferings, sources, cessations, and paths. And then he said, sufferings are to be recognized, but there is nothing to be recognized. The sources of suffering are to be abandoned, but there is nothing to be abandoned. Cessation is to be actualized, but there is nothing to be actualized. The path is to be meditated, but there is nothing to be meditated. The meaning of this is that although there are factors among the Four Noble Truths to be conventionally and validly recognized, abandoned, actualized, and meditated, there is nothing to be ultimately recognized, abandoned, actualized, and meditated. From the viewpoint of ultimate reality, all of these are beyond activity. Everything has the same taste in the emptiness of inherent existence. In this way, Buddha set out the perspectives of the two truths, conventional truths and ultimate truths. All phenomena, causes and effects, actions and agents, good and bad and so forth, merely conventionally exist, only nominally exist. They are dependent arisings. Because phenomena depend upon other factors for their existence, they are not independent. This absence of independence or emptiness of inherent existence is their own ultimate truth. You will come to comprehend this emptiness of true existence when you become dissatisfied with mere appearances and you use analysis to probe beneath the surface. When you thoroughly understand appearance and emptiness, you will also understand that they are in harmony with one another. Appearance does not preclude emptiness, and emptiness does not preclude appearance. Failing to understand this, you might believe in virtue, non-virtue, cause and effect, and so forth, but then be unable to believe in emptiness. Similarly, you might think that you understand emptiness, but then be unable to believe in the facts of cause and effect, help or harm, pleasure or pain that arise dependent upon conditions. Without proper understanding, emptiness and appearance seem to prohibit each other. However, phenomena are empty of inherent existence because they depend for their existence on other conditions. And conversely, phenomena are capable of functioning because they are empty of the solidity of inherent existence. If phenomena were not empty of inherent existence, if they did exist by their own power, then they could not be affected by other causes and conditions. They would not change. In that case, they would not cause pleasure and pain, help and harm. Good and bad would be impossible. Full realization of dependent arising brings with it the double understanding of appearance and emptiness of inherent existence. The extremes of utter non-existence and inherent existence are simultaneously cleared away by this twin understanding. Knowing that phenomena arise prevents believing in the extreme of nihilism, since it allows objects and beings to function in this world, allowing for the cause and effect of karma. Knowing that phenomena are dependent also prevents believing in the extreme of inherent existence by eliminating that phenomena exist in their own right. Through understanding these two truths, you arrive at the middle way. What is the relationship between objects and their emptiness? This profound topic is addressed in a scripture on the perfection of wisdom called the Heart Sutra, which is recited and meditated daily throughout great vehicle Buddhist countries such as China, Japan, Korea, Mongolia, Tibet, and Vietnam. It is a short and pithy presentation by Buddha about the wisdom required to overcome problems at their root, and, in conjunction with an other-directed motivation and compassionate deeds, to attain the omniscience of a Buddha. Here is the Heart Sutra in its entirety. Homage to the supramundane, victorious perfection of wisdom. This is what I have heard. At one time, the supramundane victor was residing together with a great community of monastics and a great community of bodhisattvas on Vulture Mountain in Rajagriha. At that time, the supramundane victor was absorbed in the concentrated meditation of the enumerations of phenomena called perception of the profound. At that time, the bodhisattva, the great being, the superior Avalokiteshvara, also was observing the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and was viewing even these five aggregates, forms, feelings, discriminations, compositional factors and consciousnesses, to be empty of inherent existence. Then, through the Buddha's power, the Venerable Shariputra said to the Bodhisattva, the great being, the superior Avalokiteshvara, "How should a child of good lineage, who wishes to practice the profound perfection of wisdom, train?" The Bodhisattva, great being, the superior Avalokiteshvara, replied to Shariputra, "Shariputra, sons or daughters of good lineage who wish to practice the profound perfection of wisdom should view phenomena as follows. They should correctly and thoroughly view even these five aggregates as empty of inherent existence. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. Similarly, feelings, discriminations, compositional factors, and consciousnesses are empty. Shariputra, in that way, all phenomena are empty, without characteristics, not produced, not ceasing, not defiled, not separated from defilements, not decreasing, not increasing. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness there are no forms, no feelings, no discriminations, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no forms, no sounds, no odors, no tastes, no tangible objects, no other phenomena. In emptiness, there is no eye constituent through to no mental constituent, and through to no mental consciousness constituent. In emptiness, there is no ignorance and no extinguishment of ignorance, through to no extinguishment of aging and death. Similarly, in emptiness, there are no sufferings, sources, cessations, and paths, no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, since bodhisattvas, the great beings, have no attainment, they rely on and reside in this profound perfection of wisdom. Their minds are without obstruction and without fear, having thoroughly passed beyond error they go to the finality of nirvana. Even all the Buddhas in the past, present, and future become manifestly and completely awakened into unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment in reliance on this profound perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom is the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra of thoroughly pacifying all suffering. It should be known that since it is not false, it is true. To state the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, Tadyata gatte gatte para sangatte bodhi swaha. It is thus, proceed, proceed, proceed beyond, thoroughly proceed beyond, be founded in enlightenment. In that way, Shariputra, Bodhisattva great beings should train in the profound perfection of wisdom. Then the supermundane victor rose from that concentrated meditation and said to the Bodhisattva great being, the superior Avalokiteshvara, good, 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 child of good lineage, it is so, it is so. In just the way that you have indicated, the profound perfection of wisdom should be practiced. Even the ones gone thus admire this. The supramundane victor, having pronounced this, the venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva great being Avalokiteshvara, all those in the surrounding retinue, and the worldly beings, including gods, humans, demigods, and aroma eaters, admired this and praised what the supramundane victor said. Drawing from a long tradition of Indian and Tibetan commentaries on the Heart Sutra, I will offer some food for thought on its central passage. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. This pithy statement contains much meaning. First, all persons and things are dependent upon their causes and upon their parts, and cannot exist independently of them. They are dependent arisings. Consequently, they are empty of inherent existence. Because all phenomena are dependent arisings, they have a nature of emptiness. Conversely, as beings and things have no independent or inherent nature, they must rely on other factors. They must be dependent arisings. The emptiness of forms is not separate from forms. Forms themselves, which are produced and disintegrate due to the presence of conditions, are by their own nature empty of inherent existence. This absence of inherent existence is their final reality, their mode of abiding, their final mode of being. In sum, the production and disintegration, increase and decrease, and so forth, of forms are possible because forms are empty of self-powered existence. Phenomena such as forms are said to dawn from within the sphere of the nature of emptiness. Consequently, the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. In this way, emptiness and dependent arising are shown to be in harmony. In brief, forms are not empty because of emptiness. Forms themselves are empty. Emptiness means not that a phenomenon is empty of being some other object, but that the object itself is empty of its own inherent existence. That a form is emptiness means that the final nature of a form is its natural lack of inherent existence. Because forms are dependent arisings, they are empty of an independent, self-powered entity. That emptiness is form means that this natural lack of inherent existence, which is the absence of a self-powered principle, makes possible the forms which are its sport, or which are established from it in dependence upon conditions. Since forms are the bases of emptiness, emptiness is form. Forms appear as like reflections of emptiness. In my own experience, it is easier to understand that because things are dependent arisings, they are empty of inherent existence, than it is to understand that because things are empty, they must be dependent arisings. Although intellectually I know the latter very well, experience on the level of feeling is more difficult. Nowadays, I often reflect on a statement in Nagarjuna's Precious Garland. A person is not earth, not water, not fire, not wind, not space, not consciousness, and not all of them. What person is there other than these? First, Nagarjuna considers whether the physical elements of the body, earth, which is the hard things, water, which is fluids, fire, which is heat, wind, which is air, and space, which is the empty spaces such as the gullet, could be the self. Next, he examines consciousness. Then he considers whether the collection of all of these could be the self. Finally, he rhetorically asks whether the self could be other than these. In none of these ways can the self be found. Then Nagarjuna does not immediately draw the conclusion that the self is not real. Rather, right after that stanza, he says that the self is not non-existent, but is a dependent arising, which is dependent upon the six constituents. Then, based on this fact of dependence, he draws the conclusion that the self is not real. He says, due to being set up in dependence upon a composite of the six constituents, a person is not real. Here, when he says not real, he does not just mean that the self cannot be found when sought from among or separate from the six constituents. Nagarjuna is making the point that although the mind realizing the emptiness of inherent existence sees a mere absence, that very mind promotes an understanding that the self is a dependent arising. I feel that the way he presents this is full of impact, avoiding both the extreme of holding that the self inherently exists and the extreme of holding that the self does not exist at all. Like the two signs of the hand, when looked at one way by examining its deeper nature, there is the emptiness of inherent existence. But when looked at from the other side, there is the appearance of the phenomenon itself. They are one entity. Therefore, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. You have to be able to understand that the import of emptiness is also the meaning of dependent arising. They are deeply connected. As your insight into emptiness grows clearer, you will see more and more that objects depend on causes and conditions and depend on their parts. And they bring about pleasure and pain because they do not exist inherently. If you come to feel that everything is useless because it is empty, you are mistaking emptiness for nihilism. Properly understanding emptiness means realizing how we must rely on cause and effect. The natural and full understanding of emptiness means a profound understanding of the union of appearance and emptiness. The understanding of emptiness is fantastic, isn't it? It can serve as an antidote to the misconception of inherent existence, and yet, in itself, it also assists in greater understanding of cause and effect. That is real understanding of emptiness. It is impossible to explain the import of the realization of emptiness in the context of just hearing or reading an explanation. It is something that has to be worked at over a long period of time, together with the practices of morality. These are to refrain from harm and to extend compassion, as explained earlier. It is also necessary to make supplications to Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and other teachers for help in overcoming obstacles. We need many positive causes. Summary for daily practice. Reflect frequently on how phenomena arise depending on causes and conditions, and try to see how this opposes the way phenomena and things appear to be so solidly existent, to exist in their own right, to exist inherently. If you tend toward nihilism, reflect more on dependent arising. If by concentrating on causes and conditions, you tend to reinforce the inherent existence of phenomena, then put more emphasis on how dependence contradicts this so solid appearance. You will probably be pulled from one side to the other. The true middle way takes time to find. Mind and the deep nature of mind. In the scripture on perfect wisdom, Buddha makes the following profound statement. In the mind is not to be found. The nature of the mind is clear light. To understand the levels of meaning in this statement, you have to first identify what the mind is. Then you need to analyze its deeper meaning. And finally, investigate how good and bad effects come about. Let us examine the various parts of the statement. The phrase, in the mind, is concerned with what mind is, its luminous and knowing nature. When we discussed concentrated meditation, we talked about the luminous and knowing nature of the mind and how, although it exists throughout every moment of mind, it is necessary to set aside previous thoughts and not begin new ones in order to identify it. When Buddha says, the mind is not to be found, this indicates that luminosity and knowing are not the mind's deepest and final nature. Rather, the ultimate nature of the mind is clear light, which here means its emptiness of inherent existence. You might think that Buddha is saying that the mind does not exist, but this is not the case. I, as the explainer, am explaining this statement through the workings of my own mind, and you, the listener, are hearing by the workings of your mind. We are always using the mind, and it is always right with us, but we do not know it well. Thus, even though it is difficult to identify the mind, it exists, and is being analyzed as to whether it is its own deep nature. It is clear that the mind exists, but since it is not established as its own final nature and its own basic disposition, what is its mode of being? Its deep nature is a mere emptiness of its own inherent existence. This means that the faulty defilements that pollute the mind, such as ignorance, lust, and hatred, are temporary, on the surface, and therefore separable from the mind. Once these defilements are understood to be superficial and not in the mind's basic nature, we see that the deep nature of the mind is clear light, the emptiness of inherent existence. Buddhist commentators explain in different ways the famous statement, defilements are superficial, the nature of the mind is clear light. Still, this is not a matter of Buddha's saying something so vague that it could be interpreted in any way one wishes. Rather, it has many different explicit and implicit meanings. In highest yoga tantra, there are many ways of drawing meaning out of an abstruse statement. One can explain its literal meaning, its general meaning, its hidden meaning, and its final meaning. To clarify Buddha's statement, defilements are superficial, the nature of the mind is clear light, in combination with Tantra, I will cite the Magical Array Tantra, which is a section in the repetition of the names of Manjushri Tantra. The perfect Buddhas arise from A. A is the supreme of letters. From among the four meanings I just listed, I will give a general explanation of this statement. The letter A is a negative particle in Sanskrit. It indicates emptiness, which is the absence or negation of inherent existence. When the Magical Array Tantra says that the perfect Buddhas arise from A, this means that the Buddhas dawn from within the noumenal sphere of emptiness. Or, put another way, the Buddhas dawn from within meditating on the emptiness of inherent existence. Through meditation, defilements are extinguished in the noumenal sphere of reality, which is the emptiness of inherent existence. Emptiness, symbolized by A, is the supreme topic, and therefore, the Magical Array Tantra says A is the supreme of letters. Also, from the viewpoint of highest yoga tantra, the letter A refers to the indestructible drop within which a Buddha body is achieved. In highest yoga tantra, Buddhahood arises by concentratedly focusing on the indestructible drop at the heart center. The final body of a Buddha has the nature of the indestructible drop. This adds to our understanding of the statement that the perfect Buddhas arise from the letter A. What is the indestructible drop? It is the union of the very subtle wind and the very subtle mind. Mind knows objects, whereas wind, or inner energy, causes consciousness to engage objects. Since this is the case, with a union of wind and mind, there are changes in consciousness. Consciousness is non-physical. It does not have a color or shape or the obstructive quality of physical things. Its entity is mere luminosity and cognition. And when it meets with certain conditions, such as when an object is present and a sense faculty is functioning properly, it reflects that object. That the mind changes from moment to moment and appears in different aspects indicates that the mind operates under the influence of causes and conditions. A mind arises in dependence upon a former mind of similar type, which requires that there has been an earlier, beginningless continuum of mind. If the production of a mind did not need to depend upon former moments of mind, but could just be produced causelessly, then a mind could be produced anywhere and anytime, which is absurd. Similarly, if consciousness was not produced as a continuation of a former entity of consciousness, and instead were produced from something physical, either it would always absurdly be produced, or it would never be produced, which is also absurd. This indicates that consciousness is a continuation of a former entity of consciousness. Because consciousness is based in a former moment of consciousness, there can be no beginning to its continuum. There is no beginning of consciousness, and there is no end to it. This continuum makes possible the transformation of the mind into improved states. When the mental continuum is associated with impure states, our experience is limited to the realm of cyclic existence. When the mental continuum breaks free from impure states, we can achieve nirvana. In this way, all phenomena are the artifice or the sport of the mind. The impure phenomena of cyclic existence are the sport of impure mind. The pure phenomena of nirvana are the sport of pure mind. Since it is said that in the mind is not to be found, the nature of the mind is clear light. Impure states, such as lust and hatred, are not part of the nature of mind, but must be produced by ignorance, a consciousness misconceiving inherent existence, either in the present moment or from an earlier source. All faulty states of mind have mistaken consciousness as their root. Ignorance is a form of consciousness that is mistaken about the object of its attention. It is wrong about it. It has no valid cognition as its root. A mistaken consciousness and an awareness with a valid foundation have contradictory ways of apprehending phenomena, so the one harms the other. When, in your practice, you become accustomed to correct attitudes, faulty states of mind naturally diminish until finally they are extinguished. The very system of the Buddhist teaching is based on natural contradiction. We want happiness and do not want suffering. The pain we seek to avoid mainly stems from mental attitudes. And since the source of mental suffering is afflictive emotions, either directly or indirectly, we have to consider whether there are any forces opposing them. If, for instance, anger causes suffering, then we must find a contradictory force. For anger, it is love and compassion. Although anger and love and compassion are all consciousnesses, they have contradictory ways of apprehending the same object. Their realizations are opposites. Similarly, if a room is too hot, there is no way to reduce the heat but to introduce cold. Just as heat and cold oppose each other, so too do opposing mental states, pure and impure. To the extent you develop one, the other decreases. Therefore, it is possible to remove faulty states of mind. Antidotes exist. The mind itself is a conventional truth. The reality of the mind, its emptiness of inherent existence, is its ultimate truth. These two truths are contained in one indivisible entity. Just as there is a union of the two truths, conventional and ultimate, with respect to the mind, so there is a union of the two truths with respect to each and every object. Its appearance is a conventional truth, and its emptiness of inherent existence is its ultimate truth. Final reality is known through the reasoning of dependent arising. For instance, because the mind is a dependently arisen entity, the mind is empty of existing from its own side. When you understand emptiness through the reasoning of dependent arising, you realize that all phenomena are unions of dependent arising and emptiness. Appearance and emptiness are perceived as harmonious. dependently arisen appearances of conventional phenomena provide the context for teaching compassion, which is called the vast path, as there is such a huge variety of appearances. The emptiness of the inherent existence of appearances provides the basis for teaching what is known as the profound path, because emptiness is the final nature of phenomena, peaceful, free from conceptualizations, and of one taste. Through meditatively cultivating these two paths, the vast aspect of compassion and the profound wisdom of emptiness in an inseparable way, faulty states of mind in your continuum undergo gradual transformation. They are gradually removed, and the excellent attributes of a Buddha's mind and body emerge. Buddhahood is achieved through the unified cultivation of both motivation and wisdom. However, motivation and wisdom have their own respective imprints on Buddhahood. The result of cultivating motivation is the form bodies of a Buddha, which exist for the sake of fulfilling the well-being of others. The imprint of cultivating wisdom is the truth body of a Buddha, which is the fulfillment of your own development. What are the main forms of motivation and wisdom? The primary motivation is an other-directed intention to become enlightened, inspired by love and compassion, and inspiring the practice of compassionate deeds such as giving, morality, and patience. The main form of wisdom is an intelligent consciousness realizing the emptiness of inherent existence. The foundations of Buddhism have three aspects. The basis is the two truths, conventional and ultimate. From these two truths, the path emerges with the twin factors of motivation and wisdom, each related to its respective truth. The fruit or result of travel on the path is actualization of the two bodies, the form bodies and the truth body of a Buddha. To bring this all together, on the basis of the two truths, which are the conventional and ultimate truths, you practice the two qualities of the path, motivation and wisdom. These lead you to achieve the fruit, the form and truth bodies of a Buddha. Summary for daily practice. First of all, identify the luminous and knowing nature of the mind, unclouded by thoughts. Then, probe the deeper nature of the mind again and again to reveal its absence of inherent existence, its emptiness. Do this by reflecting on the mind's dependence on causes and conditions. Also, reflect on the mind's dependence on its parts. This means that any length of time that passes in the mind depends on earlier and later parts of that time period, beginning, middle, and end. Finally, try to realize the compatibility of the appearance of the mind with its emptiness of inherent existence. See how these two mutually support each other. Part 5. Tantra. In Buddhism, there are basically two types of practices, sutra and tantra. So far, we have been discussing sutra practice. The special purpose of tantra is to provide a faster path so that qualified practitioners can be of service to others more quickly. In tantra, the power of imagination is harnessed to meditation in a practice called Deity Yoga. Deity Yoga is in three phases. 1. Replace your mind as it ordinarily appears full of troubling emotions with a mind of pure wisdom, motivated by compassion. 2. Substitute your body as it ordinarily appears, composed of flesh, blood, and bone, with a body fashioned from compassionately motivated wisdom. 3. Develop a sense of a pure self that depends upon purely appearing mind and body in an ideal environment, fully engaged in helping others. As this distinctive practice of Tantra calls for visualizing yourself with the Buddha's body, activities, resources, and surroundings, it is called taking imagination as the spiritual path. Let us consider a qualm about this practice. You are considering yourself to have Buddha qualities which you presently do not have. Is this, then, a correct type of meditative consciousness? Yes. Your mind is involved in understanding reality out of which you are appearing as a deity. Therefore, your mind, from this viewpoint, is correct. Also, you are purposely imagining yourself as having a divine body, even if you do not presently possess one. This is an imaginative meditation. You are not convinced from the depths that you actually have pure mind, body, and selfhood. Rather, based in clear imagination of ideal body and mind, you are cultivating the sense of being a deity, compassionately helping others. To be a special trainee of Tantra, that is to say, the kind of trainee for whom Buddha specifically set forth the practice of Tantra, a practitioner must have sharp faculties and have already attained stable wisdom realizing emptiness, or be ready for speedy activation of this wisdom. The requirements for just practicing Tantra are less rigorous. Still, to engage in Tantra at any level demands a powerful intention to become enlightened for the sake of others, and a feeling that this needs to be done very quickly. At the beginning of tantric practice, the basic way to develop calm abiding is to meditate on your own body as if it were that of a deity. When you meditate on a divine body, first you meditate on emptiness, gaining as much awareness of the emptiness of inherent existence as you can. When you have acclimated to this state, you use that very mind itself as the basis out of which the deity appears. The mind realizing emptiness appears as the deity and as his or her surroundings. First you meditate on emptiness. Out of that the deity appears. Then you concentrate on the deity. In this way, deity yoga combines wisdom and compassionate motivation. A single consciousness realizes emptiness and also appears compassionately in the form of an altruistic deity. In the sutra system, although there is a union of wisdom and compassionate motivation, the practice of wisdom is only affected by the force of the practice of motivation, and the practice of motivation is only affected by the force of the practice of wisdom. They are not contained within one consciousness. A distinguishing feature of Tantra is that they are contained in one consciousness. Inclusion of motivation and wisdom within one consciousness is what makes Tantra's progress so swift. When I was a young boy, Tantra was just a matter of blind faith. At age 24, I lost my own country, and then after coming to India, started really reading Tsongkhapa's explanations on emptiness. Then, after moving to Dharamsala, I put more effort into the study and practice of the stages of the path, emptiness, and Tantra. So it was only in my late 20s, after gaining some experience of emptiness, that deity yoga made sense. One time in the main temple in Dharamsala, I was performing the ritual of imagining myself as a deity of highest yoga tantra called Guhya Samaja. My mind continuously remained on the recitation of the ritual text, and when the words I myself came, I completely forgot about my usual self in relation to my combination of mind and body. Instead, I had a very clear sense of I in relation to the new, pure combination of mind and body of Guhya Samaja that I was imagining. Since this is the type of self-identification that is at the heart of tantric yoga, the experience confirmed for me that with enough time, I could definitely achieve the extraordinary deep states mentioned in the scriptures. To practice tantra, it is especially important to gain access to the transmission of blessings from previous great beings. Blessings also exist in sutra practice, but they are crucial in tantra. The initial means of entry to these blessings is through the door of initiation. There are four classes of tantras: action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga tantra, each with its own initiations to ripen the mind for practice, and each with its own meditations. Where do you receive initiation? In a mandala, comprised of ideal surroundings and divine residence, which are all manifestations of compassion and wisdom. There are mandalas of varying complexity for all four tantras. Some are painted, others are constructed from colored sands, and still others comprise a special class of concentration mandalas. In order to receive initiation and to take vows in a mandala of yoga tantra or highest yoga tantra, the lama conducting the ceremony must have the full complement of qualifications. All four sets of tantras place special emphasis on the attributes of the lama, in keeping with Buddha's detailed descriptions of teachers' qualifications for the various stages of the path. Remember also Buddha's admonition mentioned earlier to rely not just on the person, but on the doctrine. You should not be overwhelmed by a teacher's reputation. Most importantly, the teacher must know the doctrine, the practices, well. In the two lower tantra sets, action and performance, there is no clear indication that tantric vows must be taken upon initiation. Nevertheless, there are many pledges to be kept. In the two higher tantra sets, yoga and highest yoga, after receiving initiation with all of its facets, you must take tantric vows in addition to the pledges. Yoga Tantra and Highest Yoga Tantra have 14 basic vows, as well as lists of infractions to guard against. They differ in their respective paths, and therefore even the basic vows differ slightly. The practice of Tantra is mainly concerned with overcoming the appearance of yourself and your surroundings as ordinary. The aim of this is to overcome the conception of these as ordinary. Therefore, you first visualize yourself to have a Buddha's body, compassionate activities, resources, and abode. Hence, most of the pledges are concerned with substituting ideal for ordinary appearances. This imaginary substitution helps in restraining your own estimation of yourself, your companions, your environment, and your activities as being ordinary. Except for the particular vow of individual liberation that lasts just for 24 hours, all of the other vows of individual liberation are taken for an entire lifetime, although it is possible to rescind one's vows and give back one's ordination. By contrast, Bodhisattva and tantric vows extend right through to the time of highest enlightenment, as long as one has not committed a root infraction. First, one assumes the morality of individual liberation. Then, one assumes bodhisattva morality. And finally, tantric morality. Householders who take the bodhisattva and tantric vows keep a householder's version of the vows of individual liberation. The Kalachakra Tantra, which flourished during the 11th century in India and became a principal tantra of the new translation schools in Tibet, states that if there are three teachers of tantra, one with householder's vows, another with the vows of a novice monastic, and a third with the vows of a full-fledged monastic, the person who has taken the vows of a full-fledged monastic should be considered higher than the others. This indicates the high estimation that even this tantric system places on the monastic morality. The Guhyasamaja Tantra similarly says that externally you should keep the discipline of the practice of individual liberation and internally maintain an affinity for the practice of Tantra. In these ways, the practice of Sutra and Tantra work together. In the practice of Tantra, it is possible to use sexual desire in the path. Let us begin to consider the role of sexual desire in the path in Tantra by looking at the prohibition against sexual misconduct in the morality of individual liberation, which is entirely based on the principle of refraining from harming others. Specific sexual misconduct is identified in detail in Vasubandhu's Treasury of Manifest Knowledge. For a male, it would be to cohabit with someone else's wife, or with someone who is under the care of her family. For a female, it is the same. It is prohibited to cohabit with someone else's husband, or with someone who is under the care of his family. Some have suggested ridiculously that since Vasubandhu's text explains the 10 non-virtues from the viewpoint of a male, there is no fault if a female engages in the non-virtues, and thus there are no prohibitions for a female. This is ridiculous. For Buddhists, sexual intercourse can be used in the spiritual path because it causes a strong focusing of consciousness if the practitioner has firm compassion and wisdom. Its purpose is to manifest and prolong the deeper levels of mind, which I described earlier with respect to the process of dying. The aim is to put their power to use in strengthening the realization of emptiness. Otherwise, mere intercourse has nothing to do with spiritual cultivation. When a person has achieved a high level of practice in motivation and wisdom, then even the joining of the two sex organs, or so-called intercourse, does not detract from the maintenance of that person's pure behavior. Yogis who have achieved a high level of the path and are fully qualified can engage in sexual activity, and a monastic with this ability can maintain all the precepts. One Tibetan yogi adept, when criticized by another, said that he ate meat and drank beer as offerings to the mandala deity. Such tantric practitioners visualize themselves as deities in a complete mandala, within realization that the ultimate deity is the ultimate bliss, the union of bliss and emptiness, a bliss consciousness realizing emptiness. He also said that his sexual practice with a consort was undertaken for the sake of developing real knowledge, and that indeed is the purpose. Such a practitioner can make spiritual use not only of delicious meat and drink, but even of human excrement and urine. A yogi's meditation transforms these into real ambrosia. For people like us, however, this is beyond our reach. As long as you can't transform piss and shit, these other things should not be done. Buddha set out a specific series of stages on the path precisely for this reason. The preliminary stage is training in the vows of individual liberation. If you live as a monk or a nun, your conduct has a more sound basis. There is little danger of excessive distraction. Even if you cannot fully implement such vows, there is not much risk. Then, simply practice, practice, practice. Once you develop inner strength, you can control the four internal elements, earth, water, fire, and wind, or five elements if inner space is included. Once you can fully control these internal elements, then you can control the outer five elements. Then you can make use of anything. How does sexual intercourse help in the path? There are many different levels of consciousness. The potential of grosser levels is very limited, but the deeper, more subtle levels are much more powerful. We need to access these subtler levels of mind. But in order to do so, we need to weaken and temporarily stop grosser consciousness. To accomplish this, it is necessary to bring about dramatic changes in the flow of inner energies. Even though brief versions of the deeper levels of mind occur during sneezing and yawning, these obviously cannot be prolonged. Also, previous experience with manifesting the deeper levels is required to make use of their occurrence in deep sleep. This is where sex comes in. Through special techniques of concentration during sex, competent practitioners can prolong very deep, subtle, and powerful states and put them to use to realize emptiness. However, if you engage in sexual intercourse within an ordinary mental context, there is no benefit. A Buddha has no use for sexual intercourse. Deities depicted in a mandala are often in union with a consort, but this does not suggest that Buddhas have to rely on sexual intercourse for their bliss. Buddhas have full bliss within themselves. Deities spontaneously appear in mandalas in male-female union for the benefit of people with very sharp faculties who can make use of a consort and the bliss of sexual union in practicing the quick path of Tantra. In much the same way, the Tantric Buddha Vajradhara appears in peaceful aspects and wrathful aspects. But this does not mean that Vajradhara has these two aspects to his personality. Vajradhara is always totally compassionate. Rather, his spontaneous appearance in various ways is for the sake of trainees. Vajradhara appears in just the way that the trainee should meditate when using afflictive emotions such as lust or hatred in the process of the path. To corral such powerful emotions into the spiritual path, trainees cannot be imagining that they have the peaceful body of Shakyamuni Buddha. Deity yoga is required. Since in the case of hatred, for instance, it is necessary to meditate on your own body in a fierce form, Vajradhara automatically appears in the appropriate ferocious form to show the trainee how to meditate. The same is true for sexual yoga. Trainees who are capable of using the bliss arising from the desire involved in gazing, smiling, holding hands, or union must perform the appropriate deity yoga. They could not be imagining themselves as Shakyamuni, a monk. The purpose of Vajradhara's various appearances is neither to scare the trainees nor to excite desire in them, but to show how to do imaginative meditation in those forms in order eventually to overcome afflictive emotions. A Buddha is capable of appearing spontaneously without exertion in whatever way is appropriate. The form of these appearances is shaped by the needs of others, not for the sake of that Buddha. From a Buddha's own point of view, that Buddha has the total self-fulfillment of the truth body, in which he or she remains forever. Remember that tantric morality is built on the morality of individual liberation and on the morality of compassion. The aim of tantra is to achieve Buddhahood on a faster path in order to be of service to others more quickly. Summary for daily practice. Since the practice of tantra is primarily to transform how you see yourself, others, the environment, and your activities, it can be helpful to visualize yourself as having a compassionate motivation, a pure body, and conduct that benefits others. Part 6. Steps along the way. Overview of the path to enlightenment. In all forms of Buddhism, practice is based on the intention to leave cyclic existence. Additionally, in the Great Vehicle, you are motivated by the other concerned intention to become enlightened. In Tantra, through techniques that enhance the development of the concentrated meditation, which is the union of calm abiding and special insight, you can achieve the state of Buddhahood in which all obstructions, the afflictive obstructions preventing liberation from cyclic existence, and the obstructions to omniscience preventing Buddhahood, have been removed. A Buddha's qualities are described as different bodies, which can be divided into general types. The truth body, for the fulfillment of your own welfare, and the form bodies, for the fulfillment of others' welfare. Form bodies, in turn, can be divided by how they appear to beings on different levels of purity and impurity. Highly advanced trainees can access what is called the complete enjoyment body. Other levels of trainees experience a wide variety of emanation bodies. The truth body can also be divided into two types, the nature body and the exalted wisdom body. The nature body can be further subdivided into a state of natural purification and a state of purification of adventitious or caused defilements. The exalted wisdom truth body can be further divided according to many different viewpoints. Maitreya's Ornament for Clear Realization specifies 21 sets of uncontaminated exalted wisdoms, which can be subdivided into 146 sets. Let me take a moment here to address the many misconceptions about whether or not women can attain Buddhahood. In the Sutra Great Vehicle, there is no indication that a woman cannot achieve Buddhahood. However, the texts state that during the practices for accumulating merit over three periods of countless great eons, you will arrive at a time when the karma you are working at will mature as the physical marks and beauties of a Buddha. At this time, according to the Sutra Great Vehicle, it helps to have a stronger physical support, so you naturally come to have the body of a male. Those texts also say that in the final lifetime, before you achieve Buddhahood, you need to have the body of a male. However, highest Yoga Tantra, which we consider to be the final system, says that not only can a woman achieve Buddhahood, but she can do so right in this lifetime. This has been a brief explanation of 1. The ground, the two truths, conventional and ultimate. 2. The paths built on that ground, motivation and wisdom. 3. The fruits of the paths, the form bodies and the truth body of a Buddha. It is helpful to have this overview of the structure of practice, but you need to remember that realization is generated through many causes and conditions: proper understanding, accumulation of merit, and overcoming of obstructions. If you have not first accumulated merit and purified ill deeds, it is difficult to gain realization just from trying to meditate. Therefore, it is important to work through each of the prerequisites. Engagement in the prerequisites is not just a matter of filling some sort of count, or even of completing retreat for 3 years and 3 phases of the moon, as some might imagine from the fact that many retreats take this long, or for any other period of time. Instead, you must accumulate merit and purify obstructions until certain realizations are generated. You may spend your entire lifetime doing so, with the goal of improving future lives. Sometimes, because of a lack of knowledge, people who perform long retreats end up with considerable pride about the mere fact that they finished the retreat. The increase in pride yields an increase in anger, jealousy, and competitiveness. The same can happen with mere book knowledge of doctrine. It is not easy. Afflictive emotions are tricky. Practice is not something you do for a couple of weeks or a couple of years. It takes place over many lifetimes for eons and eons. As we have seen, some texts say enlightenment is achieved after accumulating the collections of merit and wisdom for 3 periods of countless great eons. If you consider this statement properly, it can encourage you to adopt a patient, persistent attitude through difficult circumstances. If learning this saddens you, this could be due to your desire to achieve Buddhahood swiftly out of your great concern for others. But it could also be a sign of insufficient courage. Enlightenment cannot be attained without working hard at it. To believe otherwise means you are harboring some form of selfishness. This is the entire process of the path. Even though Tibetans might not have wealth that can be kept in a wallet, they have this wealth that is kept in the mind. The stated good intentions of the various religions are not sufficient. We must implement them in daily life, in society. Then we can know the real value of their teachings. If a Buddhist, for instance, meditates in a temple, but outside the temple does not enact those contemplative ideals, that is not good. We must practice in daily life. The real value of practice is seen when we face a difficult period. When we are happy and everything goes smoothly, then practice seems not so urgent. But when we face unavoidable problems such as sickness old age, death, or other desperate situations, it becomes crucial to control your anger, to control your emotional feelings, and to use your good human mind to determine how to face that problem with patience and calm. If we practice this way, our first hope is that we may overcome the problem. But if not, at least the problem cannot disturb your mental peace. That is good, isn't it? You are facing the situation and retaining your peace of mind without taking drugs or trying to pull your thoughts away from it. That is why we take such great interest in our weekends and vacations. 5 days a week, you are very busy, working hard to make money. Then on the weekend, you go to some remote place with that money and have a nice time. But this means that you are trying to take your mind off your problem. However, the problem is still there. On the other hand, if you have a good mental attitude, it is not necessary to divert yourself. When you can face the situation and analyze the problem, then, like a big piece of ice in the water, it will gradually melt away. If you practice sincerely, you will experience its real value. According to Buddha's own word, his teaching will last here for 5,000 years. At the end of that 5,000 years, it will finally be destroyed by someone who is a reincarnation of Buddha himself. Since when that day comes, there will be no further value in the teaching. However, there are a billion world systems like ours, with limitless billions of those. In some of them, the teaching is newly being introduced. In some, it is waning. The teaching continually remains somewhere at all times. The Buddhas never disappear, and the teaching never vanishes. Here in one place are the summaries for practice gathered from throughout the program. Focus on one suitable for your level at this point, or you could alternate among them over the course of a week. Cultivated patiently over time, the practices will become more and more familiar, and your life will become more and more meaningful. First topic: the morality of individual liberation. 1. Examine your motivation as often as you can. Even before getting out of bed in the morning, establish a nonviolent, non-abusive outlook for your day. At night, examine what you did during the day. 2. Notice how much suffering there is in your own life. There is physical and mental pain which you naturally seek to avoid, such as sickness, aging, and death. Moreover, there are temporary experiences, like eating good food, that seem to be pleasurable in and of themselves, but, if partaken continuously, turn into pain. This is the suffering of change. When a situation switches from pleasure to pain, reflect on the fact that the deeper nature of the original pleasure is revealing itself. Attachment to such superficial pleasures will only bring more pain. Reflect on how you are caught in a general process of conditioning that, rather than being under your own control, is under the influence of karma and afflictive emotions. 3. Gradually develop a realistic view of the body through examining its constituents, skin, blood, flesh, bone, and so forth. 4. Analyze your life closely. You will eventually find it difficult to misuse it by becoming machine-like or by merely seeking money as a surrogate for happiness. 5. adopt a positive attitude in the face of difficulty. Imagine that by undergoing a difficult situation, you are also undermining worse consequences from other karmas that you would have to experience in the future. As a mental exercise, take upon yourself the burden of everyone's suffering of that type. 6. Evaluate the possible negative and positive effects of feelings such as lust, anger, jealousy, and hatred. When it becomes obvious that their effects are harmful, you will have arrived at the conclusion that there are no positive results, for instance, of anger. Analyze more and more, and gradually your conviction will strengthen. Repeated reflection on the disadvantages of anger will cause you to realize that it is senseless and even pathetic. This decision will cause your anger gradually to diminish. 7. Having recognized the scope of suffering, research its cause and identify that the source of suffering is ignorance of the true nature of persons and things, and that lust, hatred, and so forth are based on this ignorance. Realize that suffering can be removed, can be extinguished into the sphere of reality. Reflect that this true cessation is attained through the practice of morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom, the true paths. 8. Notice your attachments to food, clothes, and shelter, and adapt monastic practices of contentment to a layperson's life. Be satisfied with adequate food, clothing, and shelter. Use the additional free time for meditation so that you can overcome more problems. 9. Develop a strong wish to refrain from harming others, either physically or verbally, no matter whether you are embarrassed, insulted, reviled, pushed, or hit. Second topic, the morality of concern for others. Perform this 5-step visualization for developing compassion. 1. Remain calm and reasonable. 2. In front of you to the right, imagine another version of yourself, egotistical and self-centered. 3. In front of you to the left, imagine a group of poor people, suffering beings who are unrelated to you, neither friend nor enemy. 4. Observe these two sides from your calm vantage point. Now think. Both want happiness. Both want to get rid of suffering. Both have the right to accomplish these goals. 5. Consider this. Just as usually, we are willing to make temporary sacrifices for a greater long-term good, so the benefit of the larger number of suffering beings to your left is much more important than this single egotistical being on your right. Notice your mind naturally turning to the side of the greater number of people. Perform the ritual for the aspiration to enlightenment. First, take the 7 preliminary steps. 1. Make homage to Shakyamuni Buddha, surrounded by innumerable bodhisattvas, whom you imagine filling the sky in front of you. 2. Offer all wonderful things, whether you own them or not, including your body, your resources, and your own virtue, to the Buddhas and bodhisattvas. 3. Disclose the countless ill deeds of body, speech, and mind you have perpetrated with an intent to harm others. Regret having done them, and intend to abstain from them in the future. 4. Admire from the depths of the heart your own virtues and others' virtues. Take joy in the good things you have done in this and in previous lives, thinking, I really did something good. Also, take joy in the virtues of others, even including those of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. 5. Entreat the Buddhas, who have become completely enlightened but have not yet taught, to teach for the sake of those who suffer. 6. Supplicate the Buddhas not to pass away and to continue teaching. 7. Dedicate these 6 practices to attaining highest enlightenment. As a conclusion to these 7, offer the purified world system with all its wonders to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who teach compassion. Then undertake the central part of the ritual for aspiring to enlightenment. 1. With a strong determination to attain Buddhahood in order to serve other beings, imagine a Buddha in front of you, or your spiritual teacher as a representative of Buddha. 2. Recite 3 times, as if you're repeating after him or her, until I reach enlightenment, I seek refuge in Buddha, the doctrine, and the supreme spiritual community. Through the collections of merit of my giving, morality, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all beings. To maintain and strengthen this profound altruism in this life, perform the following. 1. Recall again and again the benefits of developing an intention to become enlightened for the sake of others. 2. Divide the day into 3 periods and the night into 3 periods, and during each of those periods, take a little time out or rouse yourself from sleep and practice the 5-step visualization given earlier. It is also sufficient to visualize the 5 steps 3 times in 1 morning session that lasts around 15 minutes, and 3 times in 1 night session for 15 minutes. 3. Avoid mentally neglecting the welfare of even 1 being. 4. As much as possible, engage in virtuous activity with a good attitude and develop a rough understanding of the nature of reality, or maintain a wish to do so and work at it. To maintain and strengthen this profound altruism in future lives, 1. Do not lie to anyone at all, unless you can help others greatly through lying. 2. Directly or indirectly help people to progress toward enlightenment. 3. Treat all beings with respect. 4. Never cheat anyone, and always remain honest. In essence, think again and again, may I become able to help all beings. Topic 3. Concentrated meditation. 1. Choose an object of meditation and focus your mind on it, trying to achieve and maintain stability, clarity, and intensity. Avoid laxity and excitement. 2. Alternatively, identify the fundamental state of the mind, unsullied by thought, just in its own state, mere luminosity, the knowing nature of the mind. With mindfulness and introspection, remain in that state. If a thought arises, just look into the very nature of that thought itself, This will cause it to lose its power and dissolve of its own accord. Topic 4. Wisdom. As an exercise in identifying how objects and beings falsely appear in perception, try the following. 1. Observe how an item such as a watch appears in a store when you first notice it. Then observe how its appearance changes and becomes even more concrete as your interest grows. Finally, observe how it appears after you have bought it and consider it to be your own. 2. Notice at various times how you yourself appear to your mind as if existent in and of yourself without depending on mind and body. 3. Then, frequently reflect on how phenomena arise depending on causes and conditions, and observe how this contradicts the way people and things appear to exist in their own right, to exist inherently. If you tend toward nihilism, reflect more on dependent arising. If by concentrating on causes and conditions, you tend to reinforce the inherent existence of phenomena, put more emphasis on how dependence contradicts this so solid appearance. You will probably be pulled from one side to the other. The true middle way takes time to find. Also, 1. Identify the luminous and knowing nature of the mind, unclouded by thoughts and without any conceptual overlay. 2. Probe the deeper nature of the mind repeatedly to reveal its absence of inherent existence, its emptiness. Reflect on the mind's dependence on causes and conditions, as well as its dependence on its parts. For the mind, any length of time, whether 1 minute or the shortest moment, depends on earlier and later parts of that time period. 3. Try to realize the compatibility of the appearance of the mind and its emptiness of inherent existence. See how these two mutually support each other. Topic 5. Tantra. Since the practice of Tantra is primarily to transform how you see yourself, others, and the environment, it can be helpful to visualize yourself as having a compassionate motivation, pure body, and activities benefiting others. Though my own knowledge is limited and my experience is also very poor, I have tried my best to help you understand the full breadth of the Buddha's teaching. Please implement whatever in this program appears to be helpful. If you follow another religion, please adopt whatever might assist you. If you do not think it would be helpful, it would be best just to leave it alone.
How to Practice was written by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and read by the translator and editor, Dr. Jeffrey Hopkins. The recording engineer was Terry Hogan, with editing by Dan McAsee and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Kelly Gilday. How to Practice, The Way to a Meaningful Life, was produced and directed by Karen Frillman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, His Holiness the Dalai Lama's Live in a Better Way, Ethics for the New Millennium, The Path to Tranquility, The Art of Happiness, and The Dalai Lama in America series. How to Practice, The Way to a Meaningful Life, is also available in book form from Pocket Books.